It's the Wonky Show from Lisbon. We've spent the day bodding around the beautiful Portuguese capital, and there's plenty of stories and reflections to share. It's all coming up.
But you get a black ribbon and you write all the sad things about your year or things that you found tough or difficult on, and then you burn it in a cauldron. And I think, and in terms of all the mindfulness workshops I have to like promote and stuff, I would probably promote a burning of sadness. I'm probably into starting that tradition.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. Not that there's been any HE news this week, so it's a study tour special. 30 student union officers and staff have spent the day talking to students, student leaders, university managers about higher education, student experience, ETCS credit, emigration, trash, all sorts of things, and we'll get to those in a minute. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to explain what we've been up to all day, as usual, three top-level guests in Lisbon. We're all in Lisbon. In Lisbon, Khadiza Hussain is VP Education at UWE Students' Union. Khadiza, your highlight of the day, please.
So there's this culture of, you know, having this wooden spoon, like a large spoon, and basically the student leader, not associated with student union, but that's like from each faculty, so you get one spoon when you're in year one or year two. So when you're, you know, going to year two, you will select another, you know, student who is a freshman. So you will be giving them that wooden spoon, like a legacy. And it's like a proper tradition and they take it very seriously. And it was really interesting to see that culture. It's like a handover sort of thing.
More on spoons later. In Lisbon, Emilia Zirka is Student Representation Officer at Lincoln Students' Union. Emilia, your highlight of the day, please.
So I learned at one of the universities, they have a kind of tradition that brings good luck, where there is a statue which is split directly in half, her name being Natasha. And I want to say if you touch her right boob, it brings you good luck to pass your exams. So yeah, that was...
And what happens with the left?
You just don't touch it. Yeah, but you could tell the difference when looking at the statue, right, which
I'm already confused. Also in Lisbon, Gary Hughes is Chief Exec at Durham Students' Union. Gary, your highlight of the day, please.
I'm a big fan of civic architecture, Jim, as you know. And Lisbon is just an amazing place. But the University of Lisbon today is just beautiful. I think it's always lovely when you can see a university that's been around for 100 years or so, has had some money spent on it. And the size of these rooms with marble and the attention to detail, it's just been a real treat.
Yes. So, yes. Now, we'll start this week, given there's no news, with subsidiarity. Gary, we met a vice rector today. What did he have to say?
Yes, Tim, we were really privileged to spend some time with, I'm not going to be able to say his name right, there's far too many vowels, Professor João Figueiredo, who is the vice rector, the deputy vice chancellor of the University of Lisbon. And I'm sure what will be familiar to many listeners is the age old debate between where does problems get raised and where do they get solved. One of the principles we often hear in the UK, of course, is centralized control. You know, I work at Durham and there's always real hankering to have decisions made locally and by the people affected by it. And that's a lovely principle. What we had at Lisbon, of course, was that it was actually two universities until 2013, the Technical University and the Classical University. And over the past 100 years, lots of individual faculties and independent institutions emerged into it. There's another one going to happen in the next year, apparently, the School of Nursing in Lisbon is going to become the Faculty of Nursing of the University of Lisbon. So it was a real insight into how he, as the Deputy Vice-Chancellor of a 52,000 strong university, doesn't actually run the place and mostly lets it run itself. But of course, as I'm sure we're going to discuss, that has its own exciting challenges. But it was really fascinating to hear the same debate in another country, but with real individual perspectives that really arise from its history, but also, of course, its future.
Yes. And of course, you know, certainly for us in the UK, lots of financial problems, lots of people at least talking in theory, potentially about mergers or alliances and so on and so on. But I mean, it sounded pretty chaotic at times, didn't it, Khadiza?
It definitely did, because I asked, like, because, you know, all of the faculty, it's like independent from each other, as Garrett mentioned. And I asked, like, when there is a conflict between each faculties, I mean, how do they, you know, manage it? As the vice vector, he mentioned they practice soft power. So I think they basically try to, you know, do negotiation between all of the faculties, whoever have the conflict, basically. But I think there was one issue they, you know, highlighted, that there was one, there was this course, I forgot the name, but three faculties wanted to run that course. But then, of course, the university wanted them to, you know, do it together. But in the end, they didn't do it. And so now they're doing, you know, getting the course like, you know, from each faculty. So it was very interesting.
Proper tricky stuff in, you know, in terms of the kind of politics of it. But I mean, one of the things, obviously, that we picked up from Amelia was this thing about, so, you know, actually where we're sat tonight recording is opposite the Higher Technical Engineering Faculty, this stunning kind of building. But about, you know, a big chunk of the academic credit in every degree in that faculty is humanities and social sciences.
The encouragement of interdisciplinary working and how a lot of students are campaigning for it to be possible for them to do interdisciplinary modules and get credits from doing other subjects. So I think a big one is around sociology with a particular engineering department, and how whether it was the engineering department that ran those sociology-based modules or whether it was the sociology faculty who almost had that specialist knowledge. Which I guess created a bit of a divide as such within the different faculties, but the students didn't essentially care where it was coming from. They just wanted it. Mm. So it was, I think they said it took a while for it to all happen, but it is now a thing that they can do modules and they can earn credits from different pieces of work. And I think that there's definitely something worth taking back to our universities at home about interdisciplinary working. And I know that in my previous kind of student union roles that I supported the course that I personally studied, and they started this year interdisciplinary modules where you had options to take modules within different courses across the school. And I think that that is something that's growing and changing, because you want more kind of, not more qualified graduates, but graduates who have a much wider knowledge than the particular degree that they originally sign up to do.
Yes, Gary, there was this fantastic quote, wasn't there, which was, it's not just a question of what we teach, but how we shape the kind of engineer the world now needs. That was, you know, students fed back, engineering students, that they wanted to do humanities modules, and then they boiled that into this. But, you know, one of my other reflections, I guess, today was, as well as all that being nice and students wanted it, it's also a very efficient way of running an overall academic program.
God, absolutely. I think it's always something when you think about the outcomes that you want, and certainly in the UK, we talk about the language of graduate outcomes, where we know that engineers need a degree of creativity and being able to talk to humans like they're humans. You know, we can't just talk to ChatGPT. And the way that the Vice Director, Professor Michaud, was speaking about it, was mostly he just lets it happen. But of course, you need to inspire and innovate and support and that sort of stuff. But from his benefit as a vice rector, he would have called the lever from the top down, would have had to convene the committee and convene a strategy and a session. And how many campuses have we been at where someone goes, we need engineers who can also talk like humans. Let's try a strategy to do that to them. So I think that local stuff, and I think what I mean to be talking about, is that engineers come to university wanting to do theatre productions. You know, they read fiction, they listen to podcasts. Like, it's already there. Like, actually, you don't need to create it, you need to allow it. But he didn't do it. Eventually, he held the space, created the space where engineering people, which I think Ryan Zanke said was about 20% of the university, I think, like a very, very large, very, I'm sure, very expensive and rich faculty, would just like to do it. Now, what he spoke about was interesting in terms of managerialism, is that then he said that 30 engineers would go, yes, actually, I'd like to do some sociology, some aspects of that. And then the sociology departments only find these 30 engineers outside the door going, we don't have rooms big enough for you. Like, we didn't expect this appetite from outside of our discipline. But, you know, if you build it, they will come. Mm. And actually, of course, people would want to do that. I think what, you know, would interest me in the future is how accessible our humanities students will find some hard science.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Actually, if we have somebody doing, I've come in to study music, but actually it turns out I need to get a bit of AI behind me to be employable.
Can I do some of that?
So can we drop you into data science? I think the big one. So actually the hurdles that I suppose many bunch of students would say you need to be able to jump to get into entry-level physics or maths. And whereas I suppose there is an assumption that if you're going into a humanities or social scientist, like, as long as you speak English, you'll be fine. And actually, that does a massive disservice to the theoretical background and the pedagogy you need to do in social science. But he seemed to be having fun. Like, he spoke about it with joy, which I suppose is quite unusual for a university senior manager.
I'll tell you what I was going to ask you about, Khadiza. So one of the other things in that faculty, right? So they had, and for hundreds of years, almost 100 years they've had this, they had a thing called the meritocracy of difficulty. And broadly, so students wrote this report and said, there's a real culture problem here, which is all the academics think are proud of how hard it is to succeed. And they said, no, you've got to shift this culture to, you can still have high academic standards, but enable more students to succeed. So, for example, they have reduced the number of assessments that are exam-based and high drama exams, and you get more attempts at your exams. Now, you've been having all sorts of interesting debates locally, haven't you, about, you know, whether you have extensions, how easy it is to get extensions and so on. What was your sense today of where they've got to in the, you know, in the places we've visited on, whether you make things just hard for the sake of it or whether you enable students? Do you know what I mean?
I mean, to be honest, we didn't speak that much about like assessment about like, you know, today, but the vice victor mentioned one bit, and that was that, you know, teaching is getting outdated with technology, you know, moving so fast. For example, AI is in place. People are using AI, and I mean, they will keep on using AI. So the teaching style,
like the wind, he said.
Yeah. So the teaching style needs to be, you know, updated and, you know, needs to be modified with, like, you know, time. But I don't know how they would do it. But I mean, definitely assessments and everything, it should be inclusive with, like, you know, having that in mind. Like, you know, you have different, you have diverse students with, you know, like different sort of like needs. So that should be, I think, applicable not only in UK, but all over the world.
Yeah, he was quite vivid, wasn't he, Amelia, about this? You know, in the end, you've got to make teaching and learning really compelling. That's how you get them back in. That's how you get them to succeed. There was, he brought everything back to, just got to make your teaching really good.
Yeah. So there was nothing about kind of getting a policy on attendance and monitoring attendance. I think a couple of the students mentioned that they have certain kind of times within their degree, towards the end of their degree, where they have to sign a piece of paper to say that they've kind of registered in. But other than that, they can just kind of do what they like. And a couple of them said that they have friends who they never ever see, and they just appear for the exams. And that would be kind of, you know, they'd be given out red cards in UK universities if that was the case. And I know that personally, we're working on with our university on a student engagement policy, but that would be nowhere seen around here.
One other thing before we come off this, Gary, they're part of one of the European university networks. And one of the networks they're a part of, the whole idea of the network is that you can build your degree in an interdisciplinary way, not just from around the university, but around the whole of Europe. And obviously the one bit of news, that almost bit of HE news we've had this week, it's kind of HE, is this letter from Labour MPs calling on the leadership to, you know, really go for this youth mobility deal and so on. I mean, is your sense that, you know, there are real opportunities here, or are UK students just going to continue to hang around the UK? Do you know what I mean?
I mean, it's really sad, isn't it? We heard today about how Portuguese students, particularly at a great university, you know, I mean, we were loads of people from student unions, but he made absolutely sure we knew where they were in the Shanghai Index. We're very proud about their mobility, and we're speaking about, you know, the rights that we no longer enjoy across Europe. There was some concern about the really high quality graduates in Portugal that were going to go and work across Europe and weren't staying in Portugal, you know, where it's an advanced economy, but obviously not as advanced as some. I think in the UK, it's just off the table, which is really depressing in so many, many ways. I think, again, not a UK HE news, but the United States is currently choosing to shoot itself in the face in the provision of its world-leading education. So graduate mobility, I think, is going to be something where over the next couple of years, we are going to see some of the assumptions we understood about graduate mobility slightly upended. I think the letter from Labour MPs this week was really interesting because it's not necessarily linked to education. You know, a lot of it is about social and cultural exchange and not the exchange of credit or acquisition of credits, just the ability to go and experience. Now, we've always felt slightly guilty about that. That's always generally a middle-class pursuit rather than something which is for the social good. Attaching it to credits does some benefit, but I don't think we've seen in the Turing or any other attempt anything like what they can just enjoy in Portugal. I suppose my overall reflection from the Portuguese discussions we've had is that how many people, how facilitated our welcome has been, but they have somebody whose job it is to accept and facilitate mobility. Yeah, because it's just, because if you don't, it never happens. And you expect it when you go somewhere else. I don't think we could have put on in the UK what we've received here, just because it would be so unusual to receive somebody wanting to learn from the UK.
Well, excellent. Back with more of this in a minute. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Steve Isherwood from the ISE, the Institute of Student Employers, who some of you with longer memories will remember as the AGR. This week on Wonky, I've been blogging about the future of work and the role of skills. There are a few facts about the future, so the impact of technology on labour markets, how students transition through education and into work, and how people need to learn to reskill, to upskill, can only be loosely predicted. But we do know that technology, AI in particular, is a disruptive force. We know that declining birth rates and longer lifespans will change the shape of all our careers and the shape of the labour market. In response to these shifts, we're seeing graduates and apprentice employers starting to consider fresh approaches to the talent strategies. Strategies that will focus less on a person's age, education and technical experience, and more on their skills, capabilities and aptitudes. I think HE has a significant role to play in this. With the caveat that skills is a problematic word, I think it's too reductive, and fully embracing a skills approach is a great opportunity to demonstrate how HE adds value to the UK economy through the triangulation of student interests, employer needs and a great education experience. Have a read of the blog and the accompanying report for more detail. I'd be great to hear your thoughts.
Now, Mac from the team has been talking to Portuguese, and let's find out who he's been chatting to.
Good evening, I'm Mac Marshall, Community and Policy Officer at Wonky, and this evening I'm joined with Beatrice, who's an elected student representative for the Executive Committee in Portugal. Beatrice, would you like to introduce yourself just very quickly?
Yes, hello, I'm Beatrice, I'm 25 years old, and I'm the elective representative of the students in Portugal for the Executive Committee of FAIR.
Amazing. What would you say, Beatrice, are some of the key national student issues which are affecting students in Portugal right now?
Okay, I guess the most important issues we need to solve as soon as possible are the accommodation. We don't have enough accommodation for all the students, and what we have, it's too much expensive. And the transportation, our public transports work really bad and with poor conditions. And yeah, I guess that's the two big ones.
And when it comes to like the day-to-day life of a student, when it comes to their studies, is there something that stands out to you that needs not just fixing, but needs enhancing and improving?
Yes, the expenses of the student life. We have like big expenses, like the food on the canteens, also the accommodation, the transport, the student fees, and the support from the government are not enough.
When you say the support from government's not enough, so students in Portugal pay fees at public universities around like 700 euros.
Yes.
But when it comes to kind of the day-to-day support, the cost for accommodation, what does that look like? Do they get any support from government?
Usually no, just the really poor ones get an extra support, but usually just the support for the fees, so it's not enough.
One thing which we've noticed today as we've been traveling around so many different student unions and associations and universities in Portugal is the amount of initiatives where students are helping other students. It's like the Godparent Initiative. Could you give us a little bit of information about that?
Yeah, I can try. Yeah, our most important role in the student unions are helping our colleagues. So we have really massive initiatives about helping our colleagues on the integration, day-to-day, the studies, everything.
Amazing. And then I suppose to kind of round off, you mentioned there's a lot of things which government needs to improve. There's a lot of things which universities need to do to make that student experience better. What, if you had a magic wand and you could fix something right now, how would you make students in Portugal's life easier?
Okay, first of all, accommodation for everyone, a bed for every student. Yeah, and I think it's the biggest one.
And I suppose something we see a lot when we visit European countries is like student housing strategies, where they're like the university and the town and the city work together to produce a plan for housing. Is that something that you think would help, or do something else, or do you need more subsidized accommodation or more just being built?
We have already that working here. Our institutes already work with the cities to have more accommodation for the students, but it's not enough, and it takes a lot of time to sort this out because it has a lot of bureaucracy and papers.
Now, next up, as ever, when we're in a European university, there's quite a lot of democracy around, Khadija.
It definitely, they told us everything about it. And the fascinating part was the vector. They get elected. So they have the general council where they have, staff members who have the voting power, and then students have voting power for the general council. So it's really interesting to see, this combination of democratic sort of system here, which was very interesting, I would say.
And one of the things I said they were quite worried, weren't they, that only 11% of students had voted for the people on their council. But I was thinking, Okay, so that's about, what, 5,000 students?
And I think...
Have taken part in the election for the leadership of the body that then selects the leadership of the university.
Yeah, but what I feel, I mean, it's still quite a big number, to be honest, if we compare it to, like, you know, our, like, you know, UK universities. And the fact, like, all of us, like, you know, the sabbatical officers, we get paid.
Mm.
But these Portuguese student leaders, they don't get paid.
Mm.
But they're doing the same sort of job. And students here, I mean, they do vote.
But just go back to the rector for a minute. Here's a question. Mm-hmm. Could Steve West win an election?
Oh. I mean, Steve West is, like, he's really nice. I mean, he's really friendly. He's open to, like, you know...
I think he probably could. But here's my other question. Should Steve West win an election rather than just get appointed, right?
That depends. That depends. But, I mean, all of the students, I mean, student leaders, we love him. Because he's open to discussion. He tried to understand it. Yeah, there's sometimes we have, like, you know, arguments or, like, you know, different opinions. But, yeah. I mean, it depends on the students and, like, you know, what sort of... things we actually... You know,
I guess an idea, if you've been elected or you're trying to get re-elected, you do have to do that legwork, don't you, then, in sort of engaging with, not necessarily all students, but certainly with the engaged students and certainly with the academics. You have to command their confidence. And I think, you know, probably people from the UK would look at this and go, what do you mean you have an election for these people? Of course we use a search firm and we, you know, appoint these people, you know, by the governing body and all of this kind of stuff. But there was something really interesting about someone having to kind of command the confidence the people they lead when they don't have a lot of hard power, but they have soft power.
Yes. So the discussion around the soft power that the members of staff did have in a university was all based around getting the right people in a room together to talk.
Yeah.
Because pretty much everyone who we met today, almost student officer wise, they were the equivalent of a school rep system, or in our case, a student experience officer. So they were very much at that faculty level, and there wasn't really anyone above them in terms of students. So the university staff, so the vector...
And their faculty deans were also elected.
Yes. Yeah. So it was a bit of a kind of shock system, I guess, in terms of the difference that makes. But everyone, as much as they are volunteers, they're so self-driven and self-motivated that they almost get as much done as us, if not more.
Yeah. Now, Gary, I guess the other thing is, you know, I mean, we've seen lots of stuff about programs, albeit that programs are much bigger. Yeah. So what we would call a course, you know, it's a tiny thing, there's 30 odd students on it, struggling to market it, you know, a course series, you know, 500 students, yeah. Much bigger, much broader. But, you know, at course level and at faculty level and at university level and of course here in Lisbon at city level, every single level, there's some sort of association.
It fascinates me because I think the things that we always forget, I think, in the UK, you know, I am a TAD of the wonky world and always do the foreign job respondent news, is that what I've loved, what I see across all countries, is that we have a pattern that in the UK, we tend to assume that people aren't already talking about their education. But for some reason, like, somebody finishes a lecture or goes home or is in the library, but there's never a way in which they can talk about their ambitions, their experience, their thoughts doing, unless we're watching them, and unless we put up the poster, unless we're... And I just think in terms of organisations of people who are trained to think about research methodologies, we spend all of our time thinking about the ways in which actual insight and evidence and experience and communities create each other. We wet ourselves and just absolutely just go, well, we did put a poster up, so it's not real. It wasn't something where there were minutes, and so it's not real. But people are... Like, the associations in, as you say, Jim, every single level are already there, and people just go and listen to them.
Yeah.
The act of thinking that if it wasn't for us, people wouldn't be talking about their library is crackers. But what we've seen today is so many evidence about volunteers, I think, as they said, at loads of different... I mean, levels might not be the right way to think about it. It might just be different places, because I've been really struck by the geography, and we might... That's probably worth a conversation in its own right. But people don't... You know, can you see the hierarchy you're swimming in? Of course you can't. But you know where you're sat, right? And you know what facilities are there, and you know where your tech rooms are, your design labs, that sort of stuff. And I think that those are probably proxies for place in some senses. Like, your lab is your lab, but the faculty office is the faculty office, and different people occupy those spaces. And students are in all those spaces. You know, I think about UK campuses where there's so few places for students.
Mm. Yes, we've seen endless places for students today. Yeah, we'll come back to that shortly. Mac's somewhere else now, talking to someone else.
Good evening, my name is Matt Marshall. I'm Community and Policy Officer at Wonky. And this evening, I'm joined with Bruno from
Air Portugal,
because I don't know what it is. Bruno, well, first of all, can you introduce yourself and kind of your role?
Yes, of course. So I'm Bruno Maia. I'm International Office for Fair Portugal, which stands for the academic forum for information and external representation. So pretty much what we do is try to take students' matters into account politically and take it also to Europe.
Amazing. And what is it like to be an international student in Portugal right now?
It's good because Portugal's academic life, it's completely different from Brazil, but it's amazing. And that's the good part. But at the same time, it's very hard because fees are really high and there is a whole set of bureaucracy that makes it hard for international students to integrate quickly into society, into your academic life as well. And then there's all the minor barriers that need to be put off in some ways. So that integration, quality of studying and, I don't know, accommodation, transportation, everything, that's a bit harder for international students than for the Portuguese students. But of course, the Portuguese students already had it very hard as well.
You kind of touched on a few challenges there, something kind of around a lot of what we see in the UK with international students is about that hidden curriculum, things which aren't immediately clear to students that they have to kind of discover and work out themselves, like transport, like that induction process. What are some of the things which maybe aren't clear to international students in Portugal when they first arrive that they've got to spend a lot of time getting their head around?
Okay, so as a whole, student life is completely different from Brazil. So at first, just getting there, despite we have this, we share the same language, right? It's very specific for most countries. So language is already a barrier in some kind of ways. The classes, the way that students interact with teachers, the way that students interact with the university, it's completely different as well. But then when we tackle the problems mentioned, like accommodation and transportation, it's a whole different country, it's a whole different way of life. So it's tough for them to get accustomed to it. There are a lot of people that try to, how do I put this, get benefited off the not knowledge, so the not knowing of those matters. And I'd say that's only the start.
Is there like a big challenge facing international students in Portugal right now from your perspective?
I'd say the biggest challenge is definitely the fees, because there is no such thing as a ceiling for the fees of international students. And pretty much each university and each faculty within the universities can decide what's the fee for the international students. So it can go all the way to 7,000 euros a year to the same price that a national student pays. So something around 750 euros a year. So that's definitely the biggest challenge. When you convert the money, right? So reais to euros, that's really tough for families. And I say that's it.
And I suppose one last thing, if there's one thing that you could kind of do, or one thing that government could do, or one thing that universities could do even, that would make international students' lives better in Portugal, what would that kind of one thing be?
Tough question, honestly. But I'd say the first thing and most important would be to make it easier bureaucratically so that the students, once they are enrolled, they have everything right to be easily integrated within a university. It's always tough because when students arrive, a lot of them have trouble with visas. A lot of them have troubles with the residency titles, right? The authorization of residence. And then, as I mentioned, it's a whole different world of academia. So I'd say inclusion on the part of the universities is a really big thing. I'd say students' unions could work a little bit more on the inclusion of international students.
Yeah. Amazing. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No.
Would you mind saying your name just like instantly?
Yes. Bruno Maia from Fair Portugal.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
And finally, I'll tell you what I've noticed today, Amelia, right? Loads of places we've been in look like they belong to students.
Yes.
Right? And I don't mean they were messy, although actually they were a bit messy. What I kind of mean is we kept walking into quite a lot of buildings, actually. You know, it's not tons of space. Quite a lot of buildings that it was just so obvious that was a space for students. And I can't remember whether you were in this conversation this morning, but one of the people that said this morning, the thing is, because they're almost all commuters, the thing is, if you are here in the morning, people have got to have some space to do things in the afternoon. I just thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, there was a real clear kind of sense of belonging from the students that we spoke to, and just the feel and the atmosphere of when you walked into these buildings, where there was lots of chairs and tables kind of in big rooms that were just kind of space to get on with it. And I think there was one student in particular who came up to us, and we were in this huge common room, who was like, oh, I've got some memories in here. And you can see the very few posters that were there said, do not move the chairs and tables. And she explicitly said, God, I've seen a few chairs thrown around this room. And you're thinking, yeah, this is definitely how I more envision university to be in terms of the craziness of some of the students. I know. But yeah, there was a lot of space used in so many different ways. And I think there was one area in particular that I was like, wow, that's cool. And it was converted kind of containers, a big, huge yellow metal container. Yeah, shipping containers. that was originally turned into kind of a gaming area, but the students very quickly were like, no, this is a party place, and we're going to put kegs in there, we're going to install draft taps, we're going to get some music on. And you can see where they'd like taped things up in this kind of towards the ceiling of it all, because they'd thrown parties there, and then they just kind of close it up and hope for the best.
Either someone that was responsible for health and safety or branding or both would have that shut down within 5 seconds in
in
the UK.
It was kind of the go-to place. And after kind of having conversations with some of the students that are based there, they said that there very much isn't an issue of that kind of drinking on campus, which some of us are seeing kind of at our home universities, because as much as there might be places in the city for students to go out to, because they know that they'll be spending time with students in their faculties and in their kind of almost societies or kind of academic society that they form within their faculties, they choose to stay because it's cheaper. They said like 50p a pint sometimes, and that just wouldn't be heard of back home.
Yeah, for all of the talk about belonging over the past 2 or 3 years, you know, endless papers, we've done research on it and so on. Honestly, still not really seen any movement in trying to get the price of things down on campus. And if things are really expensive on campus, you don't hang around, right? I mean, you know, we've been on the search for cheap places to be over the past day or two. Gary, I guess the other thing we've been on the search for, we're always on the search for this, is the secret recipe, the secret sauce. This is a country where minimum wage is actually very low. The availability of scholarships is not amazing. You know, large amounts of people's income goes on their rent, albeit that the rent is, you know, nowhere near as high as the UK. What's your sense about our endless quest to find the secret sauce this time about why students get involved and do things for other students?
I think I've been really struck. So, few thoughts on that, Jim. I think the belonging markers are there. We've seen them in loads of other places. We see them here. I absolutely reflect in the UK about how scouts and guides and, you know, the beavers and stuff have badges up their arms, and it's brilliant, and it's about competitive achievement. We saw a lot in Scandinavia and a lot of the north of Europe around overalls and like boiler suits where people sew non-competitive, and it's belonging markers. Here, I cannot tell you how delighted I am about this. They have capes and like proper woolen cloaks. And what's really fascinating about that I find in terms of the secret sauce here is that when we ask them, what do you do with them? And it's badges that indicate your family, your place where you're from. And if you're not, and love a little bit, if you're not from Lisbon, you have to go to the council in the city you're from and ask them for the badge of Porto or the Aldave or something. So you can sew it to your University of Lisbon cloak and the thrash and pass on. So there's definitely wonderful belonging markers. You know, there's other uniforms and traditions that other people have spoken about, and I'm sure will again. But the thing that I would reflect on the secret sort of thing is the, you know, and we have really been in Lisbon today, it's how the locality of, it's how people organize locally. So I think there's the geography of the city, for those who don't know Lisbon, it's basically a series of mountains connected together. Nothing is horizontal. It's horrible. But
where's my blue inhaler?
But people really congregate together, know their place and where they belong. And they have to construct what made sense for them there. So each faculty does not have the same student implementation structure. Why would it?
Yeah.
They've all got their own student volunteers who are students, and the medical students have to do it around rotations, around placements, and it works for them. The engineers do it differently again. And there is no sense of uniformity or conformity as long as it works. And I think that here has been, I think, the freest expression I've seen of that in loads of places. And it might be just because each one of the faculties we've seen has such a strong independent sense of their own identity.
Yes.
I get said they don't really need the university. They're really good.
Yes. And you know, you'll know, because I was saying this earlier, you know, in the UK, there's endless talk from kind of backbench MPs or the public or whatever about, well, you know, what happened to all the polytechnics and where's all the skills, and we need really skilled people. And occasionally someone will go, well, there's tons of skills in these programs in this university. But actually, you know, we are sat opposite one of the faculties, and you'd never know it was the University of Lisbon because it's got this massive big set of blue letters saying Technico in this huge building. And it's obviously the Technical Institute, and everyone knows that it's the Technical Institute, and everyone knows that you can do higher technical skills at the Technical Institute. You know, back in the UK, the brand police would be on saying, no, you must be the part of the University of Lisbon. You've shut down your letters. Do you know what I mean? All that stuff. I guess the other thing to these is, I mean, we've seen a kind of extreme version this afternoon, haven't we, of group social mentoring with the prash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, where they, you know, I was talking about the spoon thing and also the cape, right, mentioned. It was very interesting to see that culture, because I think it's very strong sort of culture here where you have this sort of senior students having that bonding with the, freshers coming in. And yeah, and you know, I was talking about the spoon earlier. So once you have the spoon, for example, if you're not, I mean, the freshmen, they cannot touch the spoon. So if you touch, I mean, that's like against the rule or some sort of rule they made.
And then they shout at you, and then there's assault.
One of them does something wrong.
Everybody of that group, yes, the freshmen, I mean, they'll get punished, but it's not that strict punishment. You're like, do 100 push-ups or something like that. But I mean, they have that sort of like control over their, those freshers. That doesn't happen in UK. And if we, try to practice that sort of like controlling in UK, I think student will just call 999.
But this is it, isn't it, Gary? Because there's no doubt that small groups of students in black capes yelling at each other and getting each other to do collective push-ups, there's not only would you not want to do that, no one would get that off the ground in the UK.
Yeah.
But actually, for me, that wasn't what it was about. What it was about was all the countries we visit, every time we speak to someone who's a volunteer, they don't go, I've been paid, or I'll get academic credit. Although sometimes they do get paid. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes they do get credit. What they all say is, well, someone was mentoring me in a group on my first day.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I think that given some of the language barriers, and of course, all of our hosts are phenomenally kind to speak to us in English and help us, is that we tend to ask lots of questions that are how. And when you ask them a why question, their faces go. Because it's really hard for them to talk about why they do it.
Yeah.
And because they sort of don't remember. But we really pin them down on this. Like, what this is, because they showed we were in a park and they were shouting and it was like wolves howling. But it's because somebody asked them to and helped them. Now, of course, we shouldn't disguise the fact in terms of in the UK, and people wouldn't let us control them, that not for a few years, but the initiation culture in the UK, although there's a dark side to belonging to behaviour in the Presh, has certainly had its run of history over the past 10 years. Or so of really problematic, quite difficult behaviour. What really impressed me is that they had learned, but it wasn't through a director of sports cracking down, taking them into a field and yelling at them. It was, they just went, if we do this, we will put people off. And we don't want to do that. We've gone too far. We know that. Mm. But they were speaking about that because they are not owned by a sport department or owned by an SU, nobody was going to do it for them. And they didn't want to become people that were horrible and exclusive because like their parents spoke about it. We spoke to one person whose parents had been at the same institution, spoke to them to all those things. They want to be proud of their playing so they can wear their little badges for the rest of their life. So they took ownership of their own culture change.
Yeah.
Is it perfect? No. But I do generally think it's probably a better way to do it. But the why is more interesting than the how.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I'll tell you the other thing that I think has been interesting, Amelia. We've seen a lot of people eating together.
Yes.
Right? clearly some of that will be about, types of European culture, cafe culture, blah, blah, blah. But, I don't want to sound like old father time here, right? I really don't. But just the sheer volume of people sat together eating.
Yeah.
And the sheer number of spaces that are basically designed for students to eat together.
Yeah.
It's just utterly compelling, actually.
The canteens were huge. I would say, genuinely, some of the canteens that we've seen today were the size of entire university buildings that I have on campus. And we walked through to one where we were going to have lunch, and they kind of sent us away because we were actually at the snack bar when we thought we were in the main canteen. So we'd walked through, and there was also an upstairs, but the kind of way that they'd separated the upstairs and downstairs was, if you were vegan or vegetarian, you had to go upstairs to a separate bar, just because it made service so much quicker that it was like, do you want this meat or this meat? That you just get one or the other.
I'm not sure about the social segregation of the, that was a little bit strange, but.
It was very odd, but clearly you can see because they get masses of students through. I think this one canteen was the canteen for the kind of, 8 different faculties from the whole University of Lisbon. So this is where you would meet anyone and everyone, essentially. Yeah, yeah. So they just needed to get sheer amounts of people through.
You could see
that it was just kind of rows and rows, kind of similar to how kind of like secondary school canteens are for us in the UK, I guess. In terms of the way that the tables are set out, just because they expect you to be in huge groups and sitting around. Whereas I guess at university, it's much more kind of like smaller, compact kind of cafe kind of table.
Treat.
Yes. Yeah.
Not something you do every day.
No. And the food was clearly really quite cheap as well. You kind of got, you paid for a meal, and the meal was a main meal, soup, bread, a drink and dessert.
Yeah.
All for kind of a set price of excellent chocolate mousse.
Yeah. Mousse. Yeah.
Yeah. The kind of the way that the space was laid out.
Long time since I've eaten mousse. I guess the other thing, Cadiz is right. So I was on a webinar a few weeks ago that someone was hosting, I think for Raise, the Raise network. And it was, should we pay student reps? Mm. Right. And it was the usual debate, you know, people haven't got any time, you know, the combining earning with learning, all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, obviously all of that's true, but two things strike me really. One is, I always think that's just a bit defeatist, you know, and actually we've not met a soul. And the amount of what I might call student experience delivery we have seen today, that where not a soul has been paid to do it, but they view it as being part of their student experience to do things for each other. Yeah. That's been really interesting to see, hasn't it? From students, again, that are not massively rich.
It definitely is, because you mentioned earlier that, you know, the bonding between those students are so strong that they want to, you know, have those, you know, activities going on. They have the classes. They would do the classes in the morning, and they would hang out in the students' union buildings or wherever they have their, you know, zones. They would just hang out there. They'll do lots of things. And yeah, about the lower engagement, I think when I asked one of the leaders that, oh, are students aware of the students' union here? Maybe they lack the awareness. And they straight said, like, no, I mean, they're aware of the students' union. They know what we do, but it's just the voting bit where, you know.
Yeah. At the central university level, you know, lower participation.
Yeah, we get it. Yeah. But the student engagement here, I mean, that's really interesting to see. And that's a lot of engagement that's happening without any reward or recognition.
So, Gary, anything else? Final thoughts before we wrap up?
I think the thing that we can really forget in this is the small and beautiful that we see. So we've spoken about subsidiarity in big institutions. But I think in the UK, and certainly in a lot of analysis, we forget like the really beautiful institutions, about 2,000 people on small campuses who are just little people trying their best.
Yeah.
Like we've seen lots of organisations today that actually across the city network together in brilliant ways, because it's just a good thing to do that.
Yeah.
Like actually people network together because it helps them think about new things and meet friends and have fun. And some of the campuses we've been to today, the Institute of Technology, the Institute of Engineering, when they said we've got 2,000 students, our faces just went, really? But you're doing all the belonging stuff, because that isn't dependent on infrastructure.
Yeah.
On your point about reps, that actually the infrastructure is somebody wanting to do it. Actually, if you tried to make it big, you'd kill it. It's like pinning a butterfly down, you'd just ruin it.
Yeah.
But they were able to do what the University of Lisbon with 52,000 people will do in 2,000 using volunteers.
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
It's not just that. It's staff as well, isn't it? Like that fellow we met this afternoon, the IT man. We met an IT man and he was like, well,
bless him. His wife rang him.
It doesn't really matter. It's like, if students want to do things, of course we'll. And one of our lot said, oh, yeah. Do you charge a rental fee to the students' union to borrow some of the equipment? And he looked at us like we just, you know, accused him of murder.
Yeah. Oh, bless him. He was hilarious, wasn't he? Yeah, the level of support that this university offered to its students, no matter...
Do you deliver the student experience for other students?
Yes.
Rather than...
Whether that was a festival, whether that was to make videos, whether that was just to hold any...
Study medal sessions, you know, careers work, tons of careers work being done by students for students.
They discussed making podcasts and providing equipment for that
and
how they needed to rip down walls in order to fit tiles that meant that the right wires could go in because of how much they wanted to update all their systems. It was really incredible in terms of support, I think, in particular, because we hadn't heard much about kind of media courses up until this point. And they had kind of entire green room studios, which were no bigger than kind of like small meeting rooms, but they had like 6 camera drones and all sorts. And they told us that they can't fly them anywhere near because it being in an air path. So they have particular lecturers who kind of go out of the city with all this equipment and take students with them to be able to use it, because it's something that students want and they're able to deliver that to improve that student experience. And I think it was fascinating because like those particular systems in the UK that I know of are very different because it's so difficult.
Yeah.
It was clearly a university that was trying to empower its students to do the best that they can. And that staff member in particular had a discussion with us about internships and placements, because if you were on a 2-year kind of like interim course, you had to do a internship, but you didn't have to study at the same time. It was just it was about half of your grade in that year. It was kind of the equivalent of like a semester abroad, but you'd do that kind of like a full placement. And it kind of was monitored, kind of wasn't. It was a bit of a, we kind of do a report on it, is how they explained it. But for kind of students on a full bachelor's degree, they have to study as well as do their placement. So that was quite kind of tough time for some of those students who were experiencing that. But those,
some of the employment outcomes, some of that sounded.
Yeah, it was incredible though, because I think they said they had over 1,000 different kind of companies and organizations that worked with them to put on these placements. And that varied from banks to kind of the army and the navy. And a lot of students went on to work for them. But those students who didn't, it was because they wanted to carry on with their education, because it would mean that they'd have to kind of complete their studies at the same time as working full time. But yeah, really, really incredible in terms of the support, and the staff in the university really welcome that.
Yeah.
And they really want their students to kind of succeed and have kind of excellent graduate outcomes.
Yeah. And anything final from you, Khadija?
Yeah. I mean, I think J.K. Rowling was inspired from the Cape. That's what they mentioned. I mean,
given what's been going on in the UK for the last few weeks, when suddenly one of them started piping up about J.K. Rowling coming to Portugal, seeing those academic capes and, you know, bringing that back here to inspire that, maybe, like, don't start talking about J.K. Rowling. But I guess, you know, one of the things about that, the campuses, the places, the weird, you know, capes and so on. Mm-hmm. There's something really interesting just about students being intrigued by tradition, mm-hmm. and then wanting to take part in it themselves there and remix it a little bit, or update it, or make it safer, mm-hmm. or whatever. And I guess one of, you know, the questions I always come back to is, if you're a newer university, or if you're a university that's forgotten all your traditions, or you're a university that's ditched some of the bad traditions, can you invent new ones? Do you know what I mean? It's hard to wander around Cold Arbor Lane, right? Right? And think, well, this is a campus full of tradition, right? You know what I mean? It's a load of concrete.
That's true. But then is the question based on Portugal, or are we talking about UK?
Just generally.
Generally.
Can you invent tradition?
I mean,
stories, narratives.
It's very difficult, though. I mean, somebody needs to
Made up stories.
Yeah.
Whether there are really tunnels under the, you know, the,
you definitely need at least 10 years' time to, you know, make some tradition, because if there isn't any, it's difficult. Yeah.
One thing they do in Portugal is, when you are a finalist about to graduate, they give you like a record of achievement for those people born in the 80s. like a folder with your degree on and your title. And they give everybody, and you can get coloured ribbons, where if your family's a white one, if you're a partner, it's a red one. And you write a lovely little message on it for somebody, and they fold it over and it's like a memory book. But you get a black ribbon and you write all the sad things about your year, or things that you found tough or difficult on. And then you burn it in a cauldron. And I think, and in terms of all the mindfulness workshops I have to like promote and stuff, I would probably promote a burning of sadness. Like, I'm probably into starting that tradition.
So on that bombshell, that's about it for this week. Normal service will resume next week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Khadija, Amelia, Gary, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.